This is Wink Martindale, and you're listening to Tupelo Tom and Big Lou talking.
I'm Tupelo Tom.
And I'm Big Lou.
And we're talking.
My gosh, that was perfection. That's an unedited, ad-lib, rehearsal-less. Yeah. Is rehearsal-less a word? No rehearsal. Perfection.
It's the way I live my life, Jeff. Rehearsal-less.
I like rehearsal-less.
We want to welcome everybody back to the podcast, Tupelo Tom and Big Lou talking. And we've got our producer, Alex Mitchell, with us here riding shotgun, with the shotgun.
Hello.
Hi, Alex.
How are we?
Doing well. It's about 105 here in freezing Oklahoma.
Oof. Yeah, well, that's why I don't have class outside. Very early in life, I decided I was going to pick an indoor job.
That's right.
I thought it was really cool outside sometimes when the weather was nice, but then I saw guys laying tar, and I thought, you know, I'm going to stay. I appreciate the work they do. They have to keep up with all the advances in tar, and I thank them every day when I'm driving to work, leaving my air-conditioned vehicle to go into the air-conditioned radio station. But I just, man, I appreciate the tar guys, but I'm just not going to do that, you know? Air conditioning first before I'll even consider it. Hey, and we are coming back. I don't know how you guys felt the week after Elvis week, but it took me several days. I'd never got sick. I was just exhausted. I think mentally and physically just exhausted from everything that had happened because it was a long week. It was a long week for everybody.
It definitely was a long week. And I don't know about you, Tom, but I went from the middle of the week to the middle of the week. Usually I'm going Wednesday through Sunday or something, and I was just totally discombobulated when I got back.
It was, I got there on the Thursday before everything started on Friday, and I was there through the entire next week and left late in the day on Saturday. So I was there 7, 8, 9 days, I think, at the guest house and the various venues where everything was happening, and didn't really have a whole lot of time to leave the cruise ship. I was just basically kind of right around there at Graceland doing my events and everything. And they were just spaced out perfectly enough for me not to be able to go anywhere else.
Did either of you guys lose track of what day it was during Elvis week? Because I had no clue what day it was.
Yes. Yes, I did. I got to the point. First of all, kudos to Elvis Presley Enterprises for their little brochure they had. That little multi-panel brochure that had everything listed in it, because I kept that on my desk with it open with red Sharpie circles around what I was supposed to be at and black Sharpie X's X-ing out whatever day of the week it was. So when I woke up and stumbled over to the table, I could go, okay, today's Wednesday. All right. It's the 14th. All right. And I just basically worried about the day that was in front of me.
Yep.
I didn't worry about tomorrow, and I wasn't concerned with yesterday. I'm only thinking about today.
And because most of everything I do is at night, I was just worried about the daggone pool opening up so I could hang out. So that finally happened, which was nice.
I never even saw the pool.
Oh, man. And then one day, we just drove around for a while just to get out of the building.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sunshine. But it was a great Elvis week, and we'll be talking about that soon.
We will. We'll talk about that. Following our interview that we have, that's the central point of this episode. We're very excited to have this gentleman with us. If you were a TV fan at any point in the 70s and 80s, you saw this guy. You might have grown up with this guy on television, John Schneider, Bo Duke from the Dukes of Hazzard. When I lived in Georgia, when I was working at Turner Broadcasting, I lived in Covington, Georgia for a short time, and that's where they shot the pilot for The Dukes of Hazzard and the first several episodes. So there's things from the first about 7 or 8 episodes, locations and things that I would drive by every day, like the Boar's Nest. I know where that is and drove by that all the time in Covington, Georgia, one of their locations.
Well, you know, I think I told John this when we were talking to him. When he came to the Nashville Elvis Festival a couple of years ago, you know, there's just some people that walk in the room and you go, yeah, that guy's a star. You know, and he has one of those looks, and he was such a great guy then. I loved talking to him and doing this interview. He was, and of course, my fondest memories of him, of course, Dukes of Hazzard, But I was in Nashville. I was wanting to be a singer. You know, I'm traveling, I'm touring. And when he started coming out some of those records, I loved his country voice. I still think it's one of the most underrated vocalists as far as that pure country sound that he had. And I emulated it some, you know, because that was right in my wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad I got to tell him that, you know, because that meant a lot to me.
And that's one of the things we find out in the interview. He was not one of those TV actors who decided, I'm going to do an album, I'm going to do some music. He was actually a singer. He was a performer, mm-hmm. just happened to get a job acting in a TV show. But he was a singer before. And you'll find out some interesting associations he has with Elvis, too, in
yes.
some of the songs he covered during the interview. And we did this interview back a week or so ago. And Jeff, you had a great line as we were preparing for this. We were saying that when we were recording it, we had some problems with the recording. Just generally based on the location of John.
That's right. He was in his car driving to an event. And the only way you can interview John Snyder is if he's driving in a car. Otherwise, it's not as cool.
Yeah, there's just something about, you know, in an automobile, John Schneider's just driving down the highway and you're talking to him. And I kept hoping Enos would pull him over, but he didn't, you know, but that's okay. But we wanted to bring you this conversation with John because, like you said, he has been at the Nashville Elvis Festival, loves Elvis, is a huge fan. And anytime you see him, this guy just radiates star when you see him in person.
Yes.
And he's absolutely one of the coolest guys. And so, Jeff, if you're ready with me, I can't wait to hear it again. Alex is, by the magic of Alex's editing, he has put this together in some semblance, he assures me, of making us sound like we're not just fanboying out all over the world for John Schneider.
Well, here he is, John Schneider, huh?
Talking with John Schneider, and John, it is a pleasure to have you talking with Tupelo Tom and Big Lou, and you are, as they say in wrestling, in parts unknown. We've caught you somewhere in the continental United States, I'm assuming.
Somewhere between here, there, and somewhere else.
I love that place.
Yes, yes.
In a place, you're in a position that we're very used to seeing you behind the wheel, John. I mean, you're
I am behind the wheel. I'm at a truck stop. Somewhere in Texas, I believe. In fact, you know, if you're used to seeing me this way, I'm just going to go for it. I don't care. I'm going to drive.
Just don't jump anything, okay? Don't jump any ditches while you're talking.
Well, if I want to jump something, I'll jump something.
Okay. You know what?
Where's Frog?
Jump me.
We've got the insurance.
Hey, did either of you guys see, because we've been off the air, we've been talking about Burt Reynolds and Gator and Smokey the Bandit and Hooper and Longest Yard and all those things. Any of you two, any good gentlemen ever seen Stand on It, the tribute I did to Smokey and the Bandit?
I have. Yes. And I think I know a little bit. I think I know a little bit because I was telling Big Lou before we started, the one thing I know about you that I found out kind of by accident during a conversation we were having, I think at the guest house, is you, John Schneider, are in Smokey and the Bandit.
Well, I was there and I am in it, but it's... Yes, I am standing there in Smokey and the Bandit.
You're standing on it.
But I was not kicked out, and I was not arrested. And I take those as being two very, very good things, very positive things. But I am, in fact, in the very end of Smokey and the Bandit, when the tire comes off of Jackie's car, and Sally yells, "No hard feelings, Junior." I'm going to move. I'm going to change seats in the car because I've been reminded that I'm supposed to be a law-abiding citizen these days.
These days.
So I am not going to drive the vehicle while talking to you. I'm going to sit in the passenger seat.
That's right,
yeah,
Texas.
I am there. Yeah, don't mess with Texas. I am there in the very end of the movie, but I say it sounds funny. I didn't get thrown off or arrested, but I snuck onto the set and I managed to wind up in the movie. And it was great. And then Bert wound up being a dear friend of mine later on in life, as did Hal Needham. And they both remembered this kid on the set. I was only 16. They remembered this kid that nobody knew why he was there, but nobody had the nerve to throw him off in case he was supposed to be there.
Supreme confidence. Supreme confidence, right? Even at 16.
Well, yeah, and the thing that Bert said about that was, John, no wonder you're famous.
That's great.
You know, Because you have to know which rules to follow in life, right?
Yeah.
You know?
And, you know, John, you bring up something interesting there, because that movie was, that scene was shot down at the old fairgrounds in Atlanta.
Yep, Lakewood.
And by that time, you had actually, your family had moved to Atlanta when you were a teenager.
My mother moved. She worked for IBM. She moved to Atlanta when I was 14. So 1974, we have to go this way. It's a one-way street. We have no choice. So, I mean, we do, but I'd prefer you not take it. I was living in Atlanta. I had started doing theater when I was 8 years old. So, at 16, I had been doing it for quite a while. I had been in a Burt Reynolds movie. I mean, by gosh, there was no bigger star on the planet than Burt Reynolds at that point. But I did have quite a bit of experience under my belt, enough to give me the nerve to go ahead and do that. Which I think ultimately is what gave me the nerve to walk into the Dukes of Hazzard audition with a six pack of beer. And I told them I was 24 from Snailville, Georgia. And I had just graduated first in my class at the Georgia School of High Performance Driving. Well, I was 16 from Westchester County, New York, and there was no such thing as the Georgia School of High Performance Driving.
Oh, wow.
But it is called acting, great, after all, so, you know.
Yeah, the audition starts when you walk in the door, right? Not just reading the scene.
Exactly, because, you know, this may sound cliche, but cliches are cliche for a reason. You do not get a second chance to make a first impression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And, I wanted to give them exactly what I felt they wanted, because I'd read the script and thought, oh my gosh, you know, this is me. This is like a television version of Burt Reynolds.
Exactly.
So, So I even laughed. I even laughed like that. And you know, it worked. It didn't work right away, but you know, it worked. And I go back and look at those first audition tapes. And there was no denying that we were Bo and Luke Duke.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
You know, Tom and I were as our chemistry was as palatable as Jerry and Bert.
Yeah,
without question.
And you bring up an interesting point too in that casting session. You know, actors or people forget that aren't actors. Those casting directors want to find Bo Duke. That, you know, they want someone to come in and blow them away, because that's what they're looking for. So you're helping them by.
Yeah, that's what they're looking for. But also, you know, if they don't, then that job ceases to exist. So, you know, they need to keep their cinchy jobs.
Yeah.
So if they don't cast the movie, they are casting directors after all. If you hire a mechanic to mechanic your car and they don't do it, they run out of work pretty quickly. So, yeah. So yeah, it was great.
We're about 3 months difference in age. So I'm of your era, John, and I can tell you that in the late 70s there was no one bigger than Bert on the movie screen, and there was no one bigger than Bo and Luke on television in the late 70s. I mean, you guys together were just kind of
true.
That Southern good old boy image was huge in the late 70s. There's so many knockoffs of that too that came out at the time.
Oh yeah, and I would say that you know, I don't know one that got it right. The Dukes of Hazzard was really the only version of what I call Southern horsepower comedy, where when the country people went into the city, we were instructed by Uncle Jesse to be very careful that we didn't take advantage of the folks in the city because they didn't know any better. The Beverly Hillbillies version of country goes to city. Country kind of looked like an idiot city.
Mm-hmm.
But in our version, when country went to the city failed by comparison.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's one of the reasons why so many people love the Dukes of Hazzard, because we didn't make fun of country people. We actually put them on a pedestal, much like I just put you on a pedestal.
And that first season of Dukes, you know, there you come back to the Atlanta area. You guys are shooting those first few episodes in Covington, Georgia, which is just east of Atlanta. I used to live in Covington, and that was where they shot in the 90s in the heat of the night. So you guys were kind of on the front end of that Georgia filming thing that started happening.
Well, we were as far as television goes, but Bert filmed in Georgia. They did Gator. They shot in Savannah. Longest Yard. They shot in Atlanta.
Yep.
Smoking the Bandit they shot in all around Doraville and around, you know, at those fairgrounds and all of that. So Bert was really the one that completely opened the door to filmmaking in Georgia. Bacon County Line was shot there, but I don't think any television show had been shot there. So you're right about the TV part. But Bert, which is odd to me because, you know, Bert was a Floridian. I don't know why he was so enamored with Atlanta and the surrounding area.
Yeah.
But Hal Needham, I think, also was, you know, and Hal was, Hal directed Gator and directed Smokey the Bandit, also wrote it.
Yeah, that's that relationship between Hal as a stuntman and Bert as a movie star. You know, when I saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and I know Tarantino's a big Bert fan, that's kind of the relationship I saw between DiCaprio's character and Brad Pitt's character of movie star and stunt guy. Because back in the day, you had a stunt guy that kind of followed you from picture to picture.
Oh, yeah. I had somebody that knew your walk, somebody that probably had grown your hair, grown the right haircut. So, yeah, that relationship was very important. It's still very important. We just saw a Fall Guy.
Mm-hmm.
And a dear friend of mine who was one of my, I had several stunt doubles on Dukes because we did a lot of stunts on Dukes. But his name is Jack Gill. And, he worked on Gator. I think that's the first movie he worked on. Wow. But he's been part of Stunts Unlimited and trying to get a category for an Academy Award, the Academy Awards, for stunt performers and second unit directors. So I was glad that they had mentioned that battle, at least in Fall Guy, which Fall Guy is a lot of fun. Fun movie.
Good. Yeah.
But they still don't have a category for stunt performers or second unit directors, stunt coordinators in the Academy Awards. And it's a travesty, you know, especially with all of these movies they're doing now. Jack is one of the three coordinators on the Fast and Furious franchise.
Mm-hmm.
So they need to be not only recognized, but they need to be rewarded for what they do. And not just financially rewarded, but, you know, the world needs to truly take their hats off to those guys, because without them, none of this current ilk of Marvel and DC, none of that stuff would really exist. That's probably 45% not who you think it is when you're watching the movie.
Oh, totally. And now with CGI the way it is, I mean, of the era of the stunt performer, so much is faked by CGI. I would love for these guys to get recognition when they really are putting their stuff on the line physically.
They absolutely need recognition. Many stunt performers have died entertaining people. And as far as I know, the only actors I know that have died entertaining themselves.
I worked at Turner Classic Movies for a long time and got to know some of the stunt performers from some of these old classic movies. Lauren Janes, who was a guy that did a lot of stagecoach stunts. And Bobby Hoy, who was always in fight scenes. Bobby was a guy that doubled Tony Curtis in everything. And you talked about, he knew Tony's walk. He knew the way he stood, was almost the same size, had the same hair. These guys followed the movie star around. But there was one time I was sitting around with them and I was at, and I'm blanking on his name, Terry Leonard. Had a ranch where he taught stunt work. He had a fake barn that had a bar room in it where they would practice bar room fights.
He had a horse corral
where they would practice. They had a track out back. I mean, he had all this stuff. And we were sitting around with them, and I was asking them, you know, who's one of the toughest guys you ever met that wasn't a stuntman? Because they were talking about movie stars who sometimes come in with a cocky attitude, like, I'll do that. And all of a sudden they realize what these guys can do and how good they're going to make them look if they just step aside. And they said one of the toughest guys they ever knew that was not a stuntman, and they did not know of my connection in the Elvis world. They said Red West was one of the best stunt fighters they had ever seen because he knew karate.
He's a fifth degree black belt, Red West.
He knew movement and things like that. So, you know, the Elvis thread runs strong, and as a kid like me at the time, I'm sure, watching Elvis movies, there seemed to, no matter how much he sang to the girl, there was always a fight scene or two.
Oh, there had to be. There had to be, you know, because, you know, if Elvis were here, I think he would agree that all of us really wanted to be John Wayne.
Yeah.
You know, we wanted to be John Wayne desperately because he was, you know, you didn't want to tangle with him. Sadly, Bruce Dern did successfully, and I think he became the most hated, and he's a sweetheart, but he became the most hated man after the Cowboys. It was like nobody liked Bruce Dern anymore. I think that I love the Elvis movies. And here's one other little the smart actors, and I'll bet you Elvis did this because he would appreciate movement, because I don't know what degree Black Belt Elvis finally achieved, but a smart actor will get together with their stunt double and kind of figure out how the two of you can meet somewhere in the middle. You know, how would you do this? How would you throw this punch? You know, how would you be standing? Mm-hmm. Because while it's important for a stunt double to move and look as much like the actor as possible, the real smart actor will also try to figure out a way to look as much like the stunt performer as possible. The last thing you want is for somebody who enjoys your movies to say, yeah, you know, I can tell that wasn't you when you jumped over the bridge, or I can tell that wasn't you when you got thrown over the bar. You know, we all want to be John Wayne. And even John Wayne had several, you know, one for horses, one for fights. He had stunt doubles as well.
For you, and looking at your years at Dukes, what's one of the toughest things that you and maybe your coordinator, your stunt guy, or just you yourself had to do? I would think, you know, jumping over that hood isn't easy. We've all tried it, John.
Oh,
you know,
gosh.
We've all tried it.
That's child's play. You just have to wax the hood. That's all. You have to wax the hood.
That's the important part. Ah, yes.
If you jump on the hood and you hear... That's bad. That's bad. You know, they say you can't squeal tires on dirt. Well, yes, you can, but you shouldn't squeal blue jeans on the hood of a car.
Oh, never.
The toughest thing for me was always doing anything up high because I don't like being up high. Mm-hmm. So if we had to go from one building to another or run along the ledge of a building, that would always freak me out. Tom was fine with it because Tom did a lot of roofing before he did Dukes of Hazzard. So, you know, he didn't mind being up high. I didn't like that. But Tom couldn't swim.
Oh.
So we had an episode and still can't. Because he's got like 3% body fat. I, however, do not have 3% body fat. But my favorite thing I did, there was a show where Luke had a girlfriend. The bad guys did something and we were out in a boat and somehow the girl fell in the water. And Luke was supposed to jump in the water and save her from an alligator. Well, Tom can't swim. So Tom said, hey, no, I can't. This is not I won't. This is I can't. You know, and if you don't want me to jump a car, then you surely don't want me to go in that water because I won't come out. And then Bo will have to jump in and save me. And that's not the story you're trying to tell. So I forget what happened, but she fell in the water and Luke got all upset. And I tapped him, you know, I just, you know, I'm so energetic. And so Bo jumped in the water to save the girl. I wrestled the alligator. And then I helped the girl get back in the boat and they hugged each other. And I put my arm up like, you know, I'm still here in the water, guys. So I risked life and limb and Luke got the girl. But I did have to wrestle an alligator.
Well, that's, you know, that looks good on a resume. That really looks good on a resume.
Yeah. So I did. I still have a little mark on my chest from where the, you know.
So it was a real alligator.
Yeah, it was a real alligator. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, because the stunt coordinator, Paul Baxley, said, you know, when you do this, trust me, the alligator is going to want to get away from you as much as you're going to want to get away from it.
Yeah, never maybe. Trust those guys.
Maybe, yeah. I was told that about a water moccasin once and a scorpion once, and I still don't believe it.
Yeah.
But I did it, and I had to fight, make it look like the alligator was trying to hurt me, which it wasn't. It truly was just trying to get away.
Yeah.
But that was a trip.
Golly.
You know, the weird thing about me is since the Dukes of Hazzard, when I did a movie called Christmas Cars, I jumped the General Lee for the first time, and that was like 5 years ago, 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then after that, in Stand On It, I jumped the Challenger, and then in Poker Run, I jumped the Challenger again. So I've jumped cars four times, since the Dukes of Hazzard, and I'm this guy that's been known for jumping cars for 40 something years. Well, I finally got stupid enough to do it myself. It's so much fun. It's so much fun.
I bet it is. If you know, especially if you're not having to make a car payment on the car that you're jumping at the time, you know, that's,
you don't want to do that. But you know, you are more careful when you paid for the car yourself. I it was already paid for, but I paid for it. Come on.
Yeah, all these cars. I was just looking at, because I have a Jeep Wrangler, and it says, you know, you can take that off the road. And I'm like, not while I'm making payments on it. I'm not taking it off the road. One of the things that I love too about Dukes, watching it when it was on first run, such a strong cast. I remember going to a film festival in about 1980 in Memphis at the Western and Movie Convention, and Sorrel Book was there. Came in dressed, a very dapper man, looking nothing like his character on Dukes. I mean, so educated sounding and so brilliantly dressed. And you also had another actor on the show that I love, that I found out in later years, because I went to Ole Miss in theater, that James Best had been a theater teacher at Ole Miss.
Yeah. Yeah. James Best was unbelievably good. When you asked him to cry, he would ask, which eye?
Wow.
He really would. Which eye? But Sorrel Book was from Buffalo, New York. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go up to Buffalo, New York in I think 2 weeks to do a thing called Nickel City Comic Con. But there's a very brief, I think it's a minute and 20 seconds long, but on YouTube, there's a short about Sorrel Book. He was an interrogator in the Korean War.
Wow.
Because he spoke Japanese, he spoke Korean, he spoke Chinese, he spoke German, he spoke Italian, he spoke Spanish. He made up Boss Hogg's entire language, but he loved to tell us why, if we were interested. And he's very, very bookish, man. Mm-hmm. That really looked a little bit more like Tom Bosley's brother than mm-hmm. Boss Hogg. But he would love to tell you why Boss Hogg used the word simoleons rather than greenbacks or Folden Green. And he would go through, you know, he was born here, his parents were from there, he went to school here. He had this whole history of Boss Hogg mm-hmm. that he loved to tell us. Where Boss Hogg, Jeff J.D. Hogg, spent these very informative periods of his life, formed his language. So it was wonderful talking with Sorrel. Sorrel was a great, great man and a joy to be around, and not at all in your face, not gregarious at all. He was very timid. But once you got him started, he was full steam ahead.
Because when you're shooting a show like that, and that was back in the days, you know, today I look at series and I see they, you know, their season consists of 8 episodes. You guys are making 20 plus episodes a year. Those co-stars are your family during that shooting. So Jim Best, Denver Pyle, all those people, Catherine, you're with them every day more than your own family.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody's got to get along.
Well, absolutely. I mean, some shows, I guess they didn't, but I couldn't imagine. I couldn't imagine not having, we were as close as close-knit a family unit off. Not meaning we hung around together, because, you know, we spent, it was 5 days a week, 12 hours a day, 10 months a year.
Mm-hmm.
So we did not spend the weekends together because we were, you know, we had lives.
Yeah.
So, you could see that it was palatable. Our relationship, was very, very obvious on television, and it mm-hmm. still is. Mm-hmm. I mean, a bunch of the cast are gone. I miss Denver Pyle every day. I think about Denver every day.
Mm-hmm.
But when Tom and Kathy and I do something together, we're not Bo, Luke, and Daisy, but we are that close as friends.
Yeah.
The amazing thing about that is that we are still that close, but we appeared to be that close 2 weeks after we first met.
Huh.
You know, so.
Well, instant chemistry.
It was wonderful chemistry Dee Dee and I were just talking about that a minute ago. In those days, they cast chemistry, and they took mm-hmm. a long time to make sure that the people were not just right for the individual characters, but the people were right for the individual and collective relationships.
Right, right.
mean, imagine anybody else being the snowman and Smokey and the Bandit. I can't.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and I heard stories about Bert and Jerry that were wonderfully heartwarming, that very similar to Tom Wopat, John Schneider.
Mm-hmm.
So, John, I know being a Bert aficionado, like Tom and I are massive fans as well. Talking about Jerry Reed, you have to know and love the movie WW and the Dixie Dance Kings.
Oh, God. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I guess absolutely. That was Jerry's premiere. And I want to compliment you also. I was a session singer in Nashville. I was there 20-plus years. Had a record deal. We called it the Artist Protection Program. But anyway, you were such an influence on me. I've been around enough to know, I think, is one of the best vocals on a country record ever. And I mean that from the heart.
Oh,
I've said
wow.
that behind your back, and I'm glad to say it in front of you. It's an incredible record, and your voice was perfect in that.
Well,
that,
thank
that
you.
Recording.
Thank you so much.
It,
you
wonderful.
Know, it's hard to go wrong with a Bob McDill and Dickie Lee song.
Yeah. And also, you share a unique thing with Kevin Costner, Glenn Ford, Marlon Brando. You may have heard of him. You were Superman's dad.
I was Superman's dad.
Everybody talked to Quinn Smallville coming back. That was you. So you've been a part of two of the most influential and kind of startup out of nowhere shows. There was nothing like Smallville on TV.
No.
Just like there was nothing like Dukes of Hazzard, and there you are right in the middle of it.
Well, thank you. Yeah,
it was
Smallville,
fantastic.
In fact, I spend a little bit more time now with my my television, Clark Kent, my son. I see him at Comic-Cons.
Yeah.
So, and we have that relationship, too. It's interesting. That chemistry was wonderful.
It was an amazing show. That reminds me of the story we talked about before we went officially on the air. I think I can tell it. I went to one of those Comic-Cons, and I was just a huge fan of yours, and it was before I got to meet you in Nashville, and y'all had the Smallville picture package thing.
Right.
And I walked in, and Michael Rosenbaum, am I saying that his last name right?
Right. I call him Rosenclown. But yeah.
Okay, good. He was apparently in preparation for a film or some project where he was going to play a gay character.
Oh, no.
I walk in. Now, this is 60 pounds ago. I've lost 60 pounds since then. But I walk in, and he looked at you, and he looked at Tom, and he said, would you? He's a bear. And y'all died laughing. And I said, guys, I'm right here. I can hear you. And y'all broke up so much they had to stop the photo thing, and it took like three or four minutes to find together. And everybody got mad at me because I was holding up the line.
Oh yeah, well, that's why I call him Rosenclown. Yeah, he has no shame. He has no filter whatsoever. I'm actually on my way to an event right now, and now that you reminded me of that, I'm kind of hoping he's not there. Now, I love him, but you know, there are those people where you say, oh yeah, I love him. But Tom Welling is easy to love. Tom is a great guy. Wonderful, wonderful guy. And Rosenbaum is a great guy too, but it's just kind of like,
yeah,
please. Oh, yeah.
John, you have to take credit because you told us about these two shows you're on and the great chemistry. That asks a lot. You kind of exude that. When I was around you in Nashville, you know, I sang a few songs there, and you had very nice things to say to me. But even back in the dressing room and green room, you were such a personable guy. And I feel you're one of those guys that when you meet you, it's like I've known you for years. And you must have that effect on your castmates. I mean it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that very much. It's important to get along, you know, on the set, even if you're playing people who don't get along. John Glover and I get along great. You know, we play Jonathan Kent and Lionel Luther respectively. And, but in fact, I find that it's, cause I did another show. I did a Tyler Perry show called The Haves and Have Nots, and my character didn't get along with anybody, but we all got along famously, wonderfully well. Another show with great chemistry where it's different because people who watch it, we did that show for 8 years. They would never dream that we got along off the set. But we did. We went to dinner. We went bowling. We had, you know, we had a wonderful, wonderful time doing that show. But folks who are watching, if you haven't seen that show, I strongly recommend you watch it because I make my character, Jim Clyer, makes J.R. Ewing look like a choir boy.
It's amazing too, your career. I was just thinking at these places where, you know, these comic cons and things, but just like that, you had an appearance here once in Tupelo at the Jeep dealership I was at, and every era of age group of people, you had Dukes fans, you had Tyler Perry fans, you had Smallville fans, and all law enforcement loves John Schneider. I mean, you had Mississippi Highway Patrol from the entire Northeast Corridor that were pulling into that place to meet you.
I'd rather they pull in there than pull me over out here.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's just been great. I like people, you know, I like people. So when I do a show, I think now I know that part of the magic of a television show is the magic of the relationships of the people.
Yeah.
I can't imagine working on something where people are miserable.
Yeah.
You know, because like you pointed out earlier, you know, we did a lot of shows. Even though they only do 8 shows these years, I think they take a long time to do them. I mean, I don't think they do 8 shows or a show in a week. I think maybe they do a show in a month. I'm not sure. I'd be bored to death.
Yeah.
You know, the movies, when we made Stand On It, in, I think 16 days.
Wow.
Poker Run we made, I think, in 16, maybe 15 days. To Die For, my movie about the flag. And if you haven't seen that yet, then I strongly urge you to check that out at todieformovie.com. It's a movie about a veteran, a Marine vet who just doesn't understand how I can be the bad guy and the high school quarterback that took a knee during the national anthem can be a hero. You know, what's changed about me over the last 10 years or so is I really only make the movies and that I want, and most of the time it's with, you know, I love to say I only make what I want with whom I want when I want to make it. So Christmas Cars, Stand On It, Poker Run, To Die For, these are all movies I felt that I really needed to make, and I really wanted to make because I had something to say. Stand On It, Poker Run, what I had to say was, thank you, Al. Thank you, Bert. Thank you, Jackie. Yeah. Thank you for making, you know, it came out in 1977. Thank you for making my 17th year, the year before my life would change forever. Thank you for making me appreciate Southern horsepower comedy.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of been part of my life ever since. And I want to thank those who stand for our flag and those who have sacrificed for our country. I want to thank them for their sacrifice. Because I think, you know, we live in the greatest country in the world. We have this thing called freedom, and we have the right to exercise our rights. But I think that our exercising our freedom, that stops when my exercising my freedom interferes somehow with your exercising yours. And conversely, when your exercising your freedom gets into my freedom, now we either have to have a conversation or we have a problem.
And it seems like more and more now it stops when we offend you in some way that doesn't really, it's not physically harming you in any way. It's just going against maybe perhaps something you believe based on whatever experience you've had in life. And I have this belief based on my period and you know, what I've learned in life. And we've missed out on that. Let's all get along with these different thoughts.
Communication.
Yeah. And I just saw something in the news where a bunch of, I'm just going to say it, a bunch of idiots went out to Stonehenge because they love our planet so much. They thought they would deface Stonehenge and pollute the air with aerosol spray. You know, my God, you know, at least
they caught them, by the way.
If you're good, they caught them. Good.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. You know, and I don't mind what you believe in, but I mean, come on, that it destruction of that's not just public property. I mean, that's like one of the seven, it's not one of the seven wonders. Is it one of the seven wonders of the world? Anyway, you are messing with the world when you mess with that. I mean, it's absurd. Yeah. People who do violent things, because they're upset about violent things that have been done. Just, you know, I'm told I look for logic and I look for justice too much, but I'm going to keep looking because I think I'm a logical person who believes in justice and I believe that I'm fair.
Yeah.
Now there are people out there, I guess, who don't think I'm fair, and that's let's talk about it. Why not?
Yeah, exactly. In today's world, it shows me again and again why we need music and movies and television that sometimes to inform us and to have us grow in knowledge, but other times to just watch the Duke boys going down the road, jumping. I mean, sometimes that's okay. And that's really something I think in a lot of ways we've lost because it seems like I'm preached to all day long by every media I consume.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Dukes was a magic recipe, and I'm working on something right now that I believe that I'm one of the few people. I'm going to toot my own horn here for a minute. I believe I'm one of the few people that really understands that recipe from a creative side. I'm one of the only cast members who wrote an episode, and I happened to direct that one as well. And that was opening night at the Boar's Nest. It was, in fact, the last episode. So, you know, what does that tell you? But we were not preachy, but it was always a moral play. Uncle Jesse was made very, very sure that the Dukes never took revenge on people. They took revenge on property. Waylon said once when I was in Carnival of Thrills, after Luke and I got to a fight, he said, "Pride is a terrible servant." You know, but he didn't beat us over the head with it. But it was always there. To the point where when you were a kid, if you had done something wrong and your parent said, "What do you think Uncle Jesse would do to Bo if he did that?" You'd know instantly what they were talking about, but you knew exactly what Uncle Jesse would do, even though that was never a plot line in the Dukes of Hazzard.
Yeah.
Smallville was exciting and wonderful and fantastic, but it was moral, but it was not preachy. You know, you're telling me what I didn't want him to, I wanted to put the keys when Lex Luthor gave him a new truck. I put the keys on a nail. I told him a little bit about Lionel. And he said, "So you're telling me the apple doesn't fall far from the tree?" I said, "No, I just wanted to make sure you understood where the money came from that bought that truck.
Right. Yeah.
So now Clark and the audience had to figure it out on their own.
Yeah.
Yes.
Without banging us over the head. Yeah. All of that. John, you also did something in the 80s, and a lot of people that listen to this podcast.
Okay, I'm sorry about that, and they didn't ever taught me.
No. I know you've got limited time because I can see red lights behind you, and I know that
I saw the truck, by the way. Did you see he was hiding from... Speaking of Smokey,
he was in the. You were in the rocket chair there for a second.
I'm in the rocket chair. That's right.
You had a convoy going by. Yeah.
You know, that was so much fun. And stand on it when we shot that. We did that in one take.
Wow.
And all of the truckers had phone cameras, and I used all of that footage. Okay, what did I do in the 80s?
Well, no, but to talk about Stand On It real quick, though. What a dream come true for you to be able to be Bert in that movie. We've all done that. I was that summer of 77. You talk about that magic summer of 77.
Yeah.
I worked here in Tupelo at the movie theater as a part-time projectionist house manager. The summer of 77 at the Twin Theater here, one side was Smokey and the Bandit, one side was Star Wars the entire summer.
Wow.
What a summer that was.
Sold out the whole time. Oh, my God.
Yeah, and you just went to whichever one was next.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because what people seem to have forgotten, Smokey and the Bandit was not just a movie that was on in 1977. Smokey and the Bandit was the number one movie at the box office for all of 1977 until Star Wars pushed it out of the way.
Right.
So Smokey and the Bandit wound up, when the smoke cleared, the number two movie, only beaten by Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got Southern horsepower comedy on one side, and you've got A land Far Away on the other side, far, far away. So it was a remarkable, remarkable summer. But how cool was it that I stayed true to my my Dukes of Hazzard Mopar car?
Yeah.
By making a Challenger into the Bandit Trans Am.
Yeah, that was some product placement that goes deep in the into Hazzard County. You know,
I'm very proud of that. I'm very proud of that.
what I was gonna say before I went back to that Bert part, because we all love Bert. People listening to this podcast that are Elvis fans might not know something about you, which when you told me, I was absolutely blown away. And that comes from your music career.
Yeah.
And that comes with a cover song that you did of Elvis's.
Yeah. That was in
that was great.
1980. Scotti Brothers Records, distributed through CBS. And that's why I have a kiosk across from Graceland in the Hall of Icons. I think it's Icons.
That's right. The Icons.
Not Legend,
yes.
It's the Icons. Because that song, or that version of It's Now or Never, is still the top charting Elvis cover of all time from anybody.
Yeah.
From anybody.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
So, and I remember when it was Tony Scotti of the Scotti Brothers that said, we want you to do this song. I did a couple of other songs, some new songs, and I said, I can't do an Elvis cover. And he said, no, you don't understand. With where you are now with Dukes of Hazzard, you're the only one who can do an Elvis cover, because no one would believe Leif Garrett would do it. nobody. I mean, I love the old Cassidy family, but David Cassidy, it would be a gimmick. They said, for you, no, that everybody knows. Because when I did the Mike Douglas show and the Dinah Shore show and the Merv Griffin show, they would talk about, you know, you do music, and they'd say, well, who are some of your influences? And I say, I'm just a diehard Elvis fan. I mean, I love Elvis. And my first band had Jerry Sheff and Glenn D. Harden in it.
Oh, my God.
Wow. Yeah, went on my first band to after Dukes of Hazzard, after my first album came out. That was my bass player and my piano player.
Wow.
And that's cool.
Oh, my God.
You just get cooler. How do you get cooler than you already are?
Was that weird?
I don't
know. If you look over at Glenn or you look over at Jerry and think, oh, my God, there's Jerry, there's Glenn.
Oh, all the time.
And they're on stage with me.
All the time. Yeah. And I tell you, what they said was that had Elvis not passed away, that they didn't kind of wonder, they didn't believe, they absolutely knew that Elvis Presley's favorite television show of all time would have been The Dukes of Hazzard.
Yeah.
He said, and you guys doing music, he said, Elvis would have locked you in the jungle room and kept you there until both of you died from exhaustion singing songs.
That's great.
Yeah, that was a great, great time. Great time in my life.
And you know what, John, those years of the 60s and 70s growing up as we did, I always tell people that I'll be talking to young people, and at the Elvis festivals that we attend, and that, you know, that Brian Mays and I co-produce for Nashville, that you've appeared at a couple of times, the fans are getting younger and younger. The Baz Luhrmann movie had a lot to do with that.
Yeah.
With people discovering Elvis, discovering his life, and now he doesn't belong to their grandparents or their parents. Now they've found him and are discovering his life and music. And I say it's fantastic to be young, but you know what, John? I love the age I am right now, as you are, because we had Elvis.
We did. We had Elvis.
Mm-hmm.
We had Elvis, and we, you know, we listened to that. I saw the TV special, loved it. And the two people I wanted to meet more than any two people in the world were Elvis Presley and John Wayne.
Yeah.
So, and they both, Elvis passed away a little bit before Duke started, and John Wayne passed away in 79. So he passed away. He was too sick for me to go see him. But his son, Michael, was a friend of mine for a while way back when. And he said, you know, my dad would have, you know, if he was well enough, he would have loved to have met. So, and he would have liked the Dukes of Hazzard too. Actually, he may have had the opportunity. No, he passed away the month Duke started, January 1979.
Oh,
I believe that's true. Might have been February, but then how cool would I have been?
Well, the fact that you're friends of Burt Reynolds, we're huge Burt fans, huge Duke fans, and of course, huge Elvis fans. And Burt kind of encompassed all that, I think. And you certainly extended that legacy of those three guys.
Well, that's a huge compliment and a great honor to hear you say that. Thank you so very much.
And you were also able to take that love of country music and music. I remember seeing Stagecoach, the remake of Stagecoach.
Yeah.
And you worked with some legends in that movie in the music industry. So
I did. I did. You know. But you know the funny thing about that, when we were filming that, they were the Highwaymen. That was John and Chris and Willie and Waylon.
Yeah.
Well, when we were filming it, my album, Memory Like You, was the number one album in the country.
Oh wow!
So it was very, very interesting.
So you were the biggest singer. You were the biggest singer on the set
just for
that time.
You know, that's a very volatile. Yeah. That's kind of like trying to catch a bubble.
Yeah.
So while we were there, I had the number one album. I think the Highwaymen had been the number one album a couple of weeks before, and it probably eclipsed me and became the number one album again.
Yeah.
but yes, for that time, it was Memory Like You. There were two number one songs off that album. What's a Memory Like You Doing in Love Like This? And yeah. You're the Last Thing I Needed Tonight. So because of that, I was shocked to find out that these people were aware of my music at all, but I became very, very, very close and actually did live in another version of the Jungle Room. I lived with Johnny and June. I lived in their house in Hendersonville for a year and a half there. And then they had a cabin across the street. But
wow.
So it was, those were amazing times. That's the last time I had a beard. It was just a different color. An entirely different color.
Oh, tell me about it. Well, you know what? This opportunity to talk to you, I just feel like we've, you know, just scratched the surface. And we so appreciate you joining us from the road somewhere in Texas. You, as long as we've been talking, you may be in New Mexico by now. I don't know.
I could be.
Yeah, exactly. But John, for all of us and all the people who listen to the podcast, you've been one of the people that we really wanted to talk to because of your connection with us through your music, through your television, through your movies, you know, through, you know, Dancing with the Stars or Masked Singer as yourself, just having fun. You seem to be, and by all accounts are, someone that's just having fun, that wants everyone around them to have fun. And God knows we need that.
Well, you know, it's undeniable that life is too short. We have to have fun. We have to enjoy ourselves. And not because, you know, one of these days we're going to cease to exist. But I think the older I get, the more I get into this, the more I think that there's a kind of a mandate from God that you must have fun. You must help other people enjoy themselves so that you can be ready for what it is I have you to do here.
Yeah.
You don't want to get to heaven some miserable curmudgeon. You want to get to heaven with the weight on the balls of your feet going, okay, well, that was interesting. What now?
And
so that's where I am. I am right now. I'm having a good time. And you know, there's always things going on that are trying to make you not have a good time. But to them, I say, ah, well, who was that great? I laugh in your face.
I laugh in your, I spit in your general direction.
Who was, that was Monty Python. Yeah, exactly. Monty Python. Yeah. So, hey, folks, if you're interested in anything that's going on, I do have an app. I'm very sophisticated. I have an app. It's called, took me a long time to figure out what to name it. It's called John Schneider. So you could get the John Schneider app. I did. I focus grouped that, and that's what they came up with. So I gave them a piece and didn't pay anybody a dime.
You've also got a product that has one of the greatest, speaking of focus groups, when I was told the name of your CBD product, it's absolutely the most perfect name I've ever heard
right?
for a product.
Okay, ready, folks? My CBD product, and there are gummies. The gummies are great. There's a salve, fantastic. There's an oil you put under your tongue. And at my age, I tell you what, I use that salve all the time. And I think a lot, even though it doesn't seem like it. But something that helps me turn my mind off at night is the green nighttime CBD gummy. I think it's better than relaxing in sleep. I'm sorry, Governor, but I do. I'm sorry, Governor Huckabee, but I think it is. But it's called CBOD. CBOD. And it's fantastic. It really, really is fantastic. So
I'm a customer, and I can attest to it. It's great.
Get yourself some, folks. Go check it out. I have one more thing. You just reminded me that I've got it. I've got to press.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
When I was doing Dukes, I would travel around, and one time I was actually in Hazard, Kentucky, and the sheriff said, "Do you drink moonshine?" And I said, "Is water wet?" And he said, "Come here." So he took me to the impound room where things had been confiscated, and he brought out a bottle of moonshine. He banged it on the bottom just like Uncle Jesse, so he could show me how the little beads of air somehow came up. And Uncle Jesse said, "Look at there, how she beads up." And I tasted it. It was wonderful. I was maybe 20 years old at the time. That moment, I came up with an idea for a moonshine that I didn't actually get done until last year. I said, what if the guy from Dukes of Hazzard makes a moonshine and the commercials are that somewhere deep in the mountains, there's this still. This moonshine is too good for the revenuers to destroy. So what's it called? It's called John Schneider's Revenuers Reserve.
That is great.
There's not a link on my app. Go to YouTube and check it out. And you can go to revenuersreserve.com and you can buy it online. We're in about 5 states right now. It takes a long time to get in all the states, but we're working on them right now. But it's called Revenuers Reserve. It's fantastic. And I dare you to try you some.
All right.
Well, John, while you're out there, why don't you run us 400 cases of that back across the Mississippi, back into Mississippi and
that's
and
right,
Alabama?
You know,
and
we
Georgia.
Already did that. And Stand Out. Remember, in Stand Out, we say,
"Yeah,
we already did that." But that was a movie. We're going to do it for real, right? What was that great line? Well, ain't nobody ever not done it before.
Yeah, yeah. Right? So we ain't never not done it before. That's correct.
We ain't never not done it before. That's right. And I think we said that in there. I said, "Well, that's because we ain't never not done it." It's like, yeah, okay.
Got to stop thinking it's a negative, son. Yeah.
Oh gosh,
John, thank you so much. We're going to let you go back to the road. And
all right, gentlemen,
it's been so great to have you on the show.
I'm still on the road. I think you can hear it. You can hear it. My pleasure. It's been an absolute blast.
Thank you, John. This is great.
There's a new album coming out called John Schneider's Made in America. Check that out. Made in America, brand new album coming out, and I've got a tribute kind of on there to Jerry Reed. So I think you'll like that. And there's lots of stuff going on. I'm just getting started.
Thanks a lot.
All right.
Good to see you, my friend. See you down the road.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Yeah. 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 We
that
got a bow.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you, John.
Hey folks, Schneider here, and I wanted to tell you about John Schneider's CBOD. We are bringing a touch of Southern charm to the world of CBD with our premium Tennessee-made products that you are sure to love. Our CBOD oil tinctures feature our signature apple pie moonshine flavor, and it is so good. And by the way, it has zero THC, so it's safe for work. And trust me, you are gonna love it. And more important than that, you're gonna feel great. We also have a CBOD rub-on topical balm. So, whether you're sore from jumping a car over a river like me, or just facing those aches and pains that come with age, also like me, our CBOD balm can give you the relief that you need. So why don't you give CBOD a try? Because everybody needs a little yee-haw every now and then. You can order yours now at johnschneidercbod.com. Yee-haw!
So, you know, you've kind of made it in showbiz, Jeff, when one of the Dukes of Hazzard, like, has your phone number. You know, that's
pretty cool.
That's kind of when you know that you're in some kind of showbiz world, you know? So thanks to John. Thanks to Brian Mays for getting us on the line. My co-producer from Nashville and a publicist extraordinaire who has put us in touch with a lot of great talent. And because of Brian, we had John at the Nashville Festival a few years back, did a show on Sunday night for us, and then posed for photos with everybody who wanted one. So that's how you get to be a star. Take care of everybody.
Well, we're going to mine Brian Mays even more for some future guests, hopefully.
And I got to tell you, I'm just going to go ahead and get this out there in front of everybody so she can hear it, too. I spent a lot of time during Elvis Week with Angie Marchese, and Angie has asked to be, you know, she said, I'm, you know, when am I going to be a guest on Talking with Tupelo Tom and Big Lou? And I said,
that might end up being a 10-hour episode, though.
Exactly. I told her, even on Zoom, even on a podcast, you have to bring an item. And even on a podcast, when I'm not even in the room and I'm in Tupelo and you're in Oklahoma and Alex is in Myrtle Beach, I'm wearing my white gloves when I interview Angie.
That's right. Anybody who hasn't met her, she's such a great person. And what a job. I mean, what an incredible career.
Yeah. And she's been there for 30 plus years and head of archives. And just all those great displays. And I don't know, this is a segment of the podcast that I wanted us to kind of talk about our memories of Elvis Week. One of the first things that I wanted to talk about, though, was Angie hid Easter eggs. Well, they weren't hidden. They were just there to discover in almost every room of the mansion, outfits and accessories from Elvis's career on the staircase, in the living room, in the dining room, in the kitchen. Like life-size mannequins wearing Elvis outfits, like Elvis casual wear, that if you just glanced over into the TV room when you walked down the stairs, it was like he was standing there. It was the coolest thing that she did, being able to do that. And that just kind of kept every room having a discovery to make.
Yeah. And I can't wait to talk to her and talk about how every time you tour Graceland now, there's something.
Yeah.
Either Graceland and the campus over there with all the museums. It's just an incredible job she does.
All kind of things like that. And so we just are announcing very soon, Angie, very soon, we want you on the podcast. But like I said at the top of this, we were all kind of worked and people think we get together and hang out. I hardly saw anybody that wasn't at an event I was at because we are all on such weird and different schedules.
I told a friend of mine who was going to be there, and it was their first Elvis Week, and I said, well, please don't be offended if I don't see you. I'm either in bed, in the pool, or on a stage. And that's just kind of my Elvis Week schedule.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, too, for me, because I have to be careful about who I hang out with at night, because generally I'm the one with the early morning event, and generally you guys don't have early morning events. So you have to be very careful as to who you hang out with because they could drift you over into temptation, you know? And you start doing math. Well, if I go right now, I'll get 7 hours of sleep. That's,
right.
You know, I could do one more and I could get, you know, 5 hours. I've done 5 hours before. You know, that bargain we made, you know, with ourselves.
Yeah, and you got to stay healthy too. You want to make sure, you know, there's a lot of colds floating around sometimes in the summertime. So you want to kind of be cognizant of that when you got to sing and talk all the time. So, yeah. But it was a wonderful Elvis Week for me. Yeah, your schedule was crazy.
My schedule, I think this is my 24th year of hosting events for Graceland, and it has become easier over the years just because of the central location of everything. Back in years past, a lot of people don't remember, the events were in a big tent in the parking lot there at Graceland, and the hotel was the Peabody that we stayed at. So we were driving back and forth from events to the Peabody for 15 plus years, you know, back and forth. So you had to factor that into when you were going to get to some event or something. So, but I just wanted to see if any of you guys have any great memories. I know, Jeff, one of the first times I saw you, you and Cote were producing the Last Chance, First Chance competition for the ETA festivals.
When I first got in the Elvis world as a tribute artist, the first year I competed, I was getting in every contest I could and doing well. And when I came to Memphis, I entered the Last Chance contest, and it was at the Hard Rock down on Beale Street. And it was just so much fun. I that's where I met a lot of people for the first time. That's where I first met Debbie from Tupelo, the BVDs, a bunch of the ETAs that I've become great friends with. I was just doing it for fun. I still didn't know what you did. I just sang, and I had a jumpsuit and a wig. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't know if you joked around. I didn't know if you acted like Elvis. I had no idea what to do. And I ended up getting second place. I couldn't believe it. I thought I'd won the Super Bowl, you know. And I remember there was a couple of guys, and this is a lesson I always try to tell the guys, maybe a couple out there still don't pay attention to it, but two guys really made jerks out of themselves because they didn't win. And I'll never forget one of their fans screaming at the manager at the Hard Rock, Martha Gonzalez at the time. Now, I told this story before, but it's real important, I think. And I couldn't believe how they were acting. I kind of got onto them pretty hard, and I was very Big Lou at the moment. And I put my arm around Martha and said, so she was crying. She was so upset over a contest that, by the way, didn't have a paycheck at the end of it. But anyway, the next day I get a call from Martha and says, thank you so much for last night. Would you like to have lunch at the Hard Rock? And I said, sure, I'll be right there. And we got to talking. She goes, listen, would you want to do a show here this week? Well, me being new to the Elvis world, I just assumed people were doing shows everywhere. I didn't realize that maybe other than Robert Washington, who was doing a show on Beale, everybody was just doing contests. And I was thinking, what are you guys doing? You're in Memphis. Find a bar and do a show, you know? So I did a show, and I don't know, 60, 70 people came out of the Hard Rock, and they didn't know who I was, just through Facebook, I guess. And then after Elvis Week, I got a call a few months later from the Hard Rock. A new manager said, hey, Martha Gonzalez recommended you. would you like to do some shows at the Hard Rock this Elvis Week? Well, of course, I'd love to. And all the money went to charity, and that's where we did a British Invasion, we did a movie night, and that's where the after parties were born. So it's always important for people to know that how you act when you lose will impact your career, whether it be negative and you make a fool out of yourself, or whether, like so many of the guys, we're so positive and supportive of the other contestants. And that's how we're able to do the after parties.
Yeah.
You know,
and that's one of the things, you bring up a great point. One of the things I've always said is, I can tell a lot about what kind of person you are by how you lose.
Yes.
Everybody's pretty cool when they win, but
right.
It's how you lose, that really, really makes an impression. And it's something that you notice. And as a producer, always knowing people and looking at people of who do I want to hire? Who do I want to spend time with? Well, not that guy.
That's right.
Because look at that.
And the fans see it, Tom. The fans see it.
The fans see it. Everybody sees it because they don't even try to hide it. They believe, everybody believes what they believe. And their army of fans believe what they believe. And that's great that you have a lot of people that are passionate about you. I don't appreciate reading comments on festivals and contests talking about how wrong the judges got it when those people aren't even at the freaking event.
I know, it drives me crazy.
Wow, I hope that feed you watched on Facebook really gave you the essence of the performance. And by the way, did you see the guy that won, or did you watch your guy? Is that all you watched?
Right.
Did you watch the other 2.5 hours? Because if you didn't watch it all, because guess what? The judges watch every performance.
That's right. And questioning the integrity of people that judged the events, both in Nashville and you know, and First and Last and First Chance. And these are such quality people. And the people that work so hard to get the scores to the person entering the scores, questioning their integrity is unconscionable. They're some of the best people I know. But the exciting part about it was that, you know, Hard Rock had produced The Last Chance forever. Then it went away after COVID and they moved everything to campus. And with Quick Productions, a company that kind of helped bring it back. And I'd had an idea for The First Chance. I think I told you about that, Tom, years ago, to see if you and Brian could do it. And it just didn't work out. But I thought, how great would it be to do a First Chance contest after The Ultimate?
Mm-hmm.
And you got a qualifier right away. And a few months ago, thank you, Alicia and Jen and Carla with Elvis Presley Enterprises. I just sent a message to Alicia and said, hey, listen, Quick's not going to do the contest this year. I'm passionate about this. It was my brainchild. The First Chance was. The Last Chance has always just meant so much to me. I've essentially produced it since I won it. I won it in 13, and I've basically produced it since then as far as just putting it together. And, of course, with the help of the Quicks the last 2 years. And so I got that email back. We would love for you guys to do it. So Cody Downeth and I, everybody knows Cody, the ultimate Elvis tribute artist champion from 2023. He's not the current champ anymore, but he is in our hearts. Anyway, we got together, and with Jeannie Nichols and all of our team, we all grouped up, and we put this thing together. It was a lot of hard work. Julian Sally Jr., if you live in Memphis, you know him. I called him. He's just been a powerhouse in Memphis forever on the restaurant and entertainment scene, and I wanted him to be a part of it. He was the GM at the Hard Rock for years, and he said, we got to do it at one place. I said, you tell me where. He said, Hernando's Hideaway. And I'd never set foot in that building before. I was like, yeah, I don't know, man. I've never been there. And then I went there and I thought, man, this is one of the coolest places I've ever been. Mm-hmm. And you talk to everybody in Memphis. They go, oh, my God, I love that place. Now I found out after Robert Plant's concert, that's where he went to hang out. After Tanya Tucker's concert, that's where she went to hang out. Mm-hmm. Then all the Elvis and Jerry Lee history, et cetera. So it was so great for Cody and I. It was such a passion of ours. The fans were fantastic. Our winner of the last chance, I thought he just nailed it. It was a cumulative score, and he came out every time. And it was so close, but Rodney Pennington, and then he represented us so well, top 10 in the ultimate. Yep. Then we move on to the first chance. And, man, you had more than 10 guys, but there were easily 10 guys that could have won that thing and more. I don't know how the judges were able to judge it. And it came down. Our producer, Alex Mitchell, got third place, and it was very close. And then it came down to 1 point between Riley Jenkins and Lewis Brown. 1 point out of three rounds, three judges.
Wow.
And Lewis Brown won, and he was so deservedly so. And he got runner-up in the ultimate. Yeah. And so, and then Riley was top five in the ultimate. And Riley is an example of how you act when you don't win. He wrote the most wonderful post on Facebook. And after the show, he was cracking jokes. He's such a great talent and funny guy. And I'm so proud of Lewis Brown. He's going to represent us well. So for me personally, and of course, the after parties I hosted with Dean Z, they sell out every single time. And I think they're one of the first events to sell out. The guys were fantastic. I mean, Ben Thompson, Pat Dunn, Spencer Sutherland, who we want to have on the show as well.
Yes.
All these great ultimates coming up there. David Lee, I'm forgetting. TIC was the band. They did fantastic. Cody Downath, Vic Trevino, the list goes on and on of the ultimates that came up and jammed with us, Dean Z, of course. And it was just so much fun and just rocked, and we always love the after parties. So with the first and last chance with the after parties, this was one of my most special Elvis weeks ever, and I can't wait till next year.
And I got to tell you, and I didn't talk about this at the top of the show, and I should have, but the fact that I was so busy during the week doing events, doing tours of Graceland with Angie and Linda Thompson and Jerry Schilling, that I didn't get to attend any of the ultimate. I didn't see the semifinals or the finals. All I saw was the announcement of the top five and the winner. And the winner was Emilio Santoro representing the Nashville Elvis Festival, which I had just rushed over there. Thank goodness Cody cried, because if he hadn't cried, I would have missed the announcement. So I want to thank him for doing that. He and Dean
Z. He bought
Z,
you a little bit of time.
He bought me. Every time he cried a little bit, I got a little bit closer to the venue.
It was
stunning. I mean, it was in that moment of feeling like I won the ultimate.
Yeah, because, that's right.
You know, it's 7-8 years of doing the Nashville Festival. And Emilio is such a great kid. And such unlikely song choices for someone in an ultimate competition. It goes to show, you can say there's a science to this. There's not.
No.
It's all about talent. You can sing.
Yes.
You could sing Old MacDonald and win the ultimate if you do it like Elvis. Because anybody that goes in singing Blue Moon, and by the way, the endorsement deal, we're working on the endorsement deal for Blue Moon beer.
Yes. Well, I got to witness it. When they got it down to the final five, I thought, I don't know how the judges are going to judge this. Every one of those guys, once again, could have won the ultimate. Three, if I'm not mistaken, there were three 50s acts in the final five. And
yep.
So, you know, I was rooting for all the guys. I never really have, I wanted Cody Downath to win. Of course, every now and then you have your guy. Well, I'd sure like to see him win the ultimate. All these guys were great guys. And would represent Elvis and Elvis Presley Enterprise as well. Kind of had a special place in my heart for Emilio. He's such a great guy. sweetheart, hilarious. His family's great. He's going to be in Helen, Georgia for the Jeff Lewis and Friends Festival. He's going to be in Texas, which hopefully y'all will be listening to this on your way to Waco for the Texas Elvis Festival with 49th Place Productions, ZTA Festivals. But anyway, he's going to be there. But Jeannie was on the front row, and we were texting back and forth after each performance and kind of commenting on it. And when Emilio came out for the final song and they started playing Blue Moon, I went, oh, no. What in the world is he thinking? And I texted Jeannie, what is he? Well, and there was some language involved. What the is he doing? You know, he just blew it. And I'm not a huge fan of that song anyway. But I've never seen an ETA performance where he just stood there, sang it beautifully, didn't miss a note, which is hard on that song. And yet he would subtly move. And it, so he had a moving energy on the stage and just nailed it. And when he finished, I had goosebumps. I thought, that guy just won the ultimate. And I was just so proud. And, you know, there was another guy, Jimmy Holmes, who was fantastic, and he placed third. Jimmy's another example of a guy of a class act that came out and congratulated everybody on the performances. Lewis Brown, the same thing. All those guys just represented Elvis well, and Emilio is going to be a fantastic Elvis tribute artist representing Elvis Presley Enterprises and us as Elvis fans and people who produce Elvis festivals. The more guys like that you can get in the on the team, the better.
Yeah, and Moses Snow as well. I mean, he's part of the
great
top five. Just a
absolutely
another great guy that just loves to
and
sing.
And Raleigh was great. You know, Raleigh Jenkins, again, top five. Yeah.
All those guys, to see those guys and to see, like I said, those 50s guys, three out of five, that's something really special. And I'm so excited for what the future holds for Emilio. And I'm so glad that, you know, when you do a festival, and you know your guy, if a guy wins Nashville, you know, we book him to come back as the returning Nashville champion. Luckily, we booked him to come back at Nashville champion prices and not ultimate prices.
Yeah,
so thank goodness. I don't know how closely he read that agreement, but yeah, we're the only one now, I think, that still will be paying Nashville Elvis Festival rates, not ultimate rates. And we'll gladly do that the next year.
I got you, B. I got him for the Jeff Lewis and Friends. I got him for the, you're new to the business, huh, son? Come on, join our festival. I got him at Colonel Parker prices,
yeah,
I think.
You got him at, I'll make you somebody. Just come to Helen. I'll
that's right.
I'll get your name out there so they know who
exactly
you are.
We'll drink a little Blue Moon.
And now you've booked the Elvis Ultimate Champion. And that night afterwards, after the finals, the Ultimates After Dark, where they all get on stage, they were all just ragging him about it. I mean, every one of them making fun of his choice of Blue Moon. Like, what did you do? What were you thinking? And it went down the line as they just piled on Emilio. And all he said when they all got finished was, but I won. And that's kind
right.
of it. That's kind of it. So it was a great week. That the festival, the first part of the week, I did a couple of bus tours with Angie where we drive around the Memphis area there and let the fans see. We had sold out bus tours. You see all the exciting places that Elvis, we call it the playground of Memphis because it really shows Elvis was out there a lot doing things. We go to McKellar Lake and see where he used to dock the boat from Graceland that's over in the museum, and just all around town, go by Humes High School and get out for photo ops, go to Overton Park where he did his first concert in July of 54. Go by the Mid-South Coliseum, even get to go by the location over by the fairgrounds where a few years back, Dick Grobe, Elvis's head of security, told the story about a train being stopped across the track. And Elvis gets out of the bus that they're all in coming from a football game. And Elvis goes through the stopped train cars, and Dick goes with him. And by the time the cars are gone, Elvis has vanished. They don't know where he is. And just the adventure of that night, we go back to that intersection and tell the story. So just a lot of things going on the bus tour. It was gorgeous weather for the first part of the week in Memphis. Coolest August I can remember for an Elvis week in ever. I mean, I don't remember it being this cool. The rain held off, only hit a couple of times. The heavy heat came more toward the end of the Elvis week, right there in time for Candlelight, unfortunately.
right.
For the heavy heat. Just a lot of things. Jerry Schilling was in town. I got to do a Q&A with Jerry one morning. And then I don't know if you got to see this, because again, all of us working on different schedules, but the Fan Choice Awards, it was kind of the Academy Awards of the Elvis world that were voted on by the fans. And that was a lot of fun. We've been working on that for months. Argo really helped put it together, and myself and Pat Dunn and Dean Z were hosts, and Alicia and Jen and Angie and everybody helped us put it together. We had special guests like Larry Strickland got to sing. Jillian Cartarelli was there singing. We had Jerry Schilling as a presenter, Linda Thompson, Sam Thompson as presenters. And it was just kind of an opportunity for not only us to be able to get dressed up in tuxedos, but the fans had a red carpet they walked at the beginning, kind of like at the Academy Awards, a lot of photos taken.
Very cool.
Just a lot of fun and a lot of surprises. One of the winners of the award couldn't be there. Austin Butler won Best Actor playing Elvis in a movie, but he did send a video, especially for the award show that we played. Yeah, so he didn't get to be there in person, but we were able to do that. Santa Claus made an appearance to present the favorite Christmas song. I heard Santa, you know, really brought the house down. Everybody was talking about how incredible Santa was. It was a lot of fun. I didn't get to see him. I was in another room when he was there. Kind of like what happens to Clark Kent when every time Superman shows up. But just so many different things. And like I said, it all kind of runs together. But when I look at this, I got the brochure here in front of me. I remember every little moment. I got to tell you, one of the things that stands out to me, there was a moment when I was... this is a story that begins. So I'm sitting at the bar. In the guest house, and I'm sitting with Rianne, Ben's wife, and Victor comes over. And Victor sits, and we're all three talking, and we all three have our phones out on the bar in front of us, face up, so we can see if we get any important messages. And at one point, Vic gets a message. It pops up, and when it pops up, his screen lights up, and he's got a picture of his dog on his screen, you know, on the whatever you call that, lock screen. And I touch my screen, and there's a picture of my dog Stella, and then Rianne touches her screen, and there's a picture of Max on their screen. And look, there. Alex has his up right now.
That's great.
So everybody had their dog on their lock screen.
That means there was very good people at that bar. You know, Tom, we have to give a shout out to all the performers, the fans. But to Elvis Presley Enterprises, they really knocked it out of the park this year with so many unique and different events. But I had a very personal thing that happened that meant a lot to me. And those out there that are calorically challenged, us men of size, I had a health scare, as a lot of people know, last year, and I decided to change some things. And I started a healthy diet, and I'm proud to say that I'm about a pound, so I'm hoping that by tomorrow from 100-pound weight loss. And my goal was to go to Lansky's during Elvis Week when I started this whole thing. And a lot of you big folks out there, big guys like me, will be laughing when they hear this. I just wanted to buy a shirt off the rack. That was my only goal in life. I've known Hal for several years now, friend of mine. I walked in. He didn't recognize me, which is super cool. It took him a minute. And he walked, of course, you know how, he walked me right over to the shirts.
Oh, yeah.
And there it was. I found my favorite shirt. I went in the dressing room. It fit, was almost borderline too big, but fit perfect. And I must admit, I reached my goal, and I shed just a small little tear. But that was a big, personal, cool Elvis memory I'll have forever.
That's very nice, and congratulations. So it's, are we changing the name of the show to Tupelo Tom and not as Big Lou Talking?
Maybe Medium Lou. Medium, I don't know.
Medium Lou,
yeah,
Talking?
Yeah, 40. We don't have to worry about anything. If I lose 40 more pounds, I'm still medically obese, so we're still okay.
I don't like their definitions they use anymore about that. But it was just a wonderful Elvis week, and I know everybody has their own memories and experiences. And Alex, congratulations to you for having won a preliminary and competing in the ultimate.
Yes. And doing a great job.
Yeah.
Well, thank you guys very much. It was great to be at the ultimate. But I like what you guys said about the contest and people not agreeing with results, because that's their opinion based on their bias for their individual that they like. But at the same point, the results are the opinion of whatever four people are back there in their perception of Elvis.
Yeah, I mean, I was a judge in the first 3 years of the competition. And this was before I really even knew any of the guys. I mean, they were just guys appearing on stage. To the majority of judges, That's exactly how you appear on stage. You're just a guy dressed up like Elvis. They don't know you. They don't follow you on Facebook. Most of the judges have professional careers and they're off doing things. A lot of the judges do know the individual, but everybody just judges what's on the stage. And if you're competing, you have to believe that because that's the truth. I always am fascinated when people say, well, it's rigged. I didn't win. Well, you were in it. If you'd won, would you be okay with it if it was rigged that way? Because it's either rigged or it's not rigged. I don't understand. You can't have it both ways. I don't want to come down too heavy and too negative on everybody because everybody's passionate about it. I would hope and that's great that they are. And I would hope that we are all there for the same reason. I've told judges before, don't be impressed by the applause when somebody walks out because he hadn't done anything yet. Those are just the people he brought with him. Be impressed when that person is finished if the rest of the people join in just as enthusiastically as the army he brought with him. That's a guy who just won over the audience. And remember, this is hard to remember sometimes, vocals count twice. And I would venture to say a lot of Emilio's points came from the fact that I think you could probably drop the needle on Elvis and drop the needle on Emilio, and it's right in the wheelhouse right there. It is crazy. And you brought up a good point, too, about when you stand there and do nothing, every little thing is magnified. And I only got to see these on video when it was over because I didn't see anything. His hound dog was amazing. He did this thing with his jacket on the beat with his jacket, and I'm like, dude, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen. I mean, I've never seen that before. And a couple of quick shout outs. Linda Thompson is one of the nicest people I have ever spent time with. We did several of the mansion tours and she greeted everybody when they got there, 10 people. She greeted them. They did photos. They took those photos off and they had them developed into 8x10s. Angie then took those 10 people around the mansion on a quick little tour and they ended up in the jungle room where Linda and I were sitting and we did a 1 hour conversation that really was led by me, but it was questions from everybody that was there. The 10 people that had paid to be there to see Linda had an opportunity to ask her anything they wanted. And the conversation just flowed from the people that were there. But the cool thing for me was for that hour and a half that they were on the tour before they got to the jungle room with Linda, I got to sit in this back room. The annex is what they call it. I got to sit back there and Linda and I and her friend Pam, we just sat around and talked for an hour and a half. And that was so spending quality time with somebody that is now your friend named Linda that really has nothing to do with the Elvis connection or showbiz or anything. It's just stories about her grandkids and stories about animals and dogs and travel and favorite places you've ever been and travel nightmares and just everything under the sun that we were back there talking about. And I got the same experience with Jerry Schilling, just to spend time with him back there waiting on the fans to come. And we did his interview. Get this. So Linda's in the jungle room, right? She's sitting in the jungle room. Everybody's in their chairs on that landing. Jerry's interview, the fans are in the racquetball court up on that upper level by the metal guardrail thing. The seats are there and Jerry and I are sitting down by the piano in the part of the racquetball court right there where, I mean, my right elbow is 5 inches from the piano that he played on August 16th. And it is an opportunity to make new friends and to spend time with people that maybe that you don't get a lot of time with. Spencer Sutherland has quickly become one of the coolest guys. I mean, he was cool before I knew him, but to be able to sit with him and talk with him, and I mean, all the girls love him and they love his music and I love his music as an older gentleman, because he has embraced the sound of my youth with his music. It's an interesting mix of styles and flavors, and his essence on stage and in videos is everything I grew up with in the 70s about music that I love and performers that I love. And he just has captured that. And I was looking at his schedule and I haven't brought this up to him, but I'm hoping maybe he'll hear this. He's in Nashville on the Wednesday night. We begin the Nashville Elvis Festival on Thursday.
Oh, really? Well, I'll be there.
And his next appearance is Wednesday night in Nashville and Friday night in Atlanta, which is right down the road. That means he's open on Thursday night.
Uh-oh. I hear a podcast and a headliner.
I just want to throw that out there, that if there was ever going to be a pop-in, Spencer, I'll save you a parking space.
Well, let me tell you, he gives on stage, there's nothing left when he walks off, and I don't care if it's at one of his sold-out concerts, which are amazing to see video of, or at the after parties. He gives it all, and we hung out at the pool a lot, and he gave me a really nice compliment about my weight loss as well. And I told him, I said, man, we want you on that podcast. He's like, just give me a ring. So we'll try to get him on here. I'd love to see him in Nashville. That's good news.
He's got a huge tour coming up, too. So he's going to be all over the place. And his music is online now. Drama. Just find Spencer Sutherland and Drama, and you'll hear what I'm talking about with the influences of everything he loves, but the music of my generation. That, you know, from a guy who loves Elvis, you hear it all in there, you know, mixed together.
Yes.
So I got to hang with him, and just a wonderful time. And a special thanks to Linda. I told Linda about my mom, and about she's turning 95 in October. And she was the reason I got into Elvis. She was the rocker that had all the records. And she asked me my mom's name. And then the morning that Lisa, my wife, and brought my mom to the conversations, when Linda got off stage, she was like, where's Polly? I want to see Polly.
That's
and
great.
I mean, the day that my mom had to be able, Linda came off stage and sat and talked to her for 30 minutes. And then Larry Schilling asked my mom if she wanted to go have lunch, and we could come along too if we wanted.
That's so cool.
So Jerry took my mom to lunch, and we got to tag along. So it was an incredible week of spending time with friends, no matter who those friends are.
Well, I think that's a great wrap up of Elvis Week, man. I'm glad those stories kept coming to our minds, because, yeah, I think they're fun to share. And just, I hope the people that we talk about realize how much they mean to us.
And, you know, Jeff, one thing I had written down here that I'd forgotten about, to meet all the other Elvis podcasters. We met a lot of other Elvis podcasters. And there is, just like in the Elvis ETA world, at least my feeling about it is, I'm for everybody doing a podcast about Elvis, because we all have our perspective on what he means to us.
Yeah, and the girls have got that great picture finally. And Alex, pitch their podcast real quick.
That would be the Pink Cadillacs podcast. That's Sky and Victory. You can find them. Just search at Pink Cadillacs or the Pink Cadillacs podcast on Apple Music, Spotify, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, YouTube, even. They're great.
And they're doing things that are so unique and you know, young and cool. And it was so great to finally all four of us be in the room together. And they took a picture, which I need to get a copy of that, by the way. So that's just another great cap off.
We've probably gone viral and don't even know it.
That's right.
It is on our Instagram, and it's currently our highest performing post.
Of course it is.
With almost at 400 likes. And people are dying for a Talkin' and Pink Cadillacs collab episode.
Oh, I love it. We'll do it. That'll be great.
I'm blown away we have an Instagram. I had no idea.
Too. Do I find that on Instagram?
Do I need an app for that? I think I do. I need an app for that. Oh.
What number do I dial?
Well, I safe travels to everybody, no matter where you're going, if you're headed out in your automobile or if you're just walking around listening to us walking the dogs. Thanks for listening. And now that we have wrapped up Elvis Week, we're at this recording headed for Waco, Texas, and then parts unknown after that. We got more on the books for the rest of the year. I'm Tupelo Tom.
And I'm Big Lou.
And we're done talking. Yeah, that's right. We are done.
All right, you betcha.
We have Instagram? Wow.
I know. I got to look at Instagram. I'm on it. I'm trying to figure out how. It says my Facebook thing is linked to it, but whatever. They're telling me post on Facebook.